Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 22nd, 2013. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Ben Mills from Fossil Cove in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I sit down to discuss some details from his sour mash beer and to sample a strange mystery beer that I brewed. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. We have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on Google Plus, too. And thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how that works. Whenever you feel like Amazon shopping, go to our site first, basicbrewing.com. Click on our Amazon link. That will take you to Amazon. Then you can shop as you normally do. It won't cost you any extra to do so, and you'll be helping us to bring this show. We greatly appreciate your support there. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app in the iTunes Store and our Android app on Amazon.com. And we're on the BlackBerry Podcast Directory, too. We're on the Stitcher app, and we're on the Windows Phone Directory, too. Check out our Brewers Logbook at BasicBrewingShop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews, and there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks very much to everybody who has done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com as well. Big news, everybody. I finally found time to brew yesterday. Usually not big news, but I looked in my brewer's logbook and I realized that, it's been way too long since I heated up a brew pot. So when I found out that I had the time, I took a look at the ingredients that I had on hand, and I brewed up what I'm calling a spur-of-the-moment saison. It's not a traditional saison, if such a thing exists. It's made with two-row malted rye, Hollertauer hops, Amarillo hops, and Mosaic hops. And pitched with the packet of Bell Saison yeast that I got in my goodie bag at the National Homebrewers Conference. I've been curious to know how that turns out. I wrote up the details of the brew session, including my recipe, on beerandwinejournal.com, so go and check that out. Beerandwinejournal.com, lots of good things going on over there. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Dan from Beloit, Wisconsin, asks, everyone has heard that you should use your homegrown hops at the end of the boil for flavor and aroma. My question is, has anyone used their homegrown hops for first wort hops to increase the flavor, or should I just stick to the end of the boil, / knockout additions, as traditionally done? Well, I myself haven't used homegrown hops as first wort hops, but I'm sure that some of you have. I'm assuming that homegrown hops act as commercial hops. The only difference is that you don't know the alpha acid level of your own homegrown hops, so the bitterness may be not as predictable as commercial hops. So if you've used your homegrown hops as first wort hops, drop me a line and let me know. See, let me know if it's any different from the more predictable commercial hops. Barry from Gainesville, Florida writes, I want to do 1-gallon batches so I can brew more often and experiment more. The guys at my local homebrew store advised against it, mostly because I would spend so much more on yeast. I'd have to brew before my yeast died in the fridge, and I would never know the cell counts. Well, as you know, I love small batch brewing, and if you've watched Basic Brewing video from the past few months, you've seen Steve and me do a bunch of small batch brewing. There are a couple of strategies for saving money on small batches as far as yeast is concerned. First of all, you can use dry yeast and only use a couple or three grams of yeast out of the packet. And then if you're very careful to sanitize your scissors, say when you cut open the package and all that, you can use a vacuum sealer or a Ziploc bag to save the rest of the packet in the fridge. and I've done so successfully. So secondly, you can also use liquid yeast. If you use liquid yeast, you can use that to ferment your 1 gallon batch and use part or all of the dregs from your small batch as a starter for a bigger batch of beer. So you just pretend like instead of making a 1 gallon batch of beer, you're just making a 1 gallon starter, and just use the dregs as you would if you were making a starter. So that's the way you can stretch your yeast budget with smaller batches. Finally, here's a note from Charlie, who writes after hearing last week's show from Salt Lake City. Charlie says, I was listening to your podcast about the Beehive Brew-Off, and I have a problem with the comments made by Matt about judging a bottle that has problems. I'm a national BJCP judge, and when I encounter a beer that has significant problems that might indicate a bottle issue, I always try and ask for another bottle to make sure that it's not just a bottle problem. The entrant has paid good money for his beer to be judged properly. In most competitions, they send in more than one bottle, so asking for another bottle to check to make sure that it's a batch problem and not a bottle problem should be attempted. At some competitions, they will not do this because it's a hassle finding another bottle, or if they want to move the judging along. I would note this on the scoring sheet if I couldn't try another bottle. So thanks, Charlie. Always good to hear a different opinion. And I was curious about that. I guess different folks do it different ways. But I know if I had a gusher sent into a competition, I'd like to have another chance. So anyway, there you go. Appreciate your sending in your two bits there, Charlie. We have a real-life sponsor this week. You know that Basic Brewing Radio is one great way to stay in touch with all things home brewing. Another great way to learn more about brewing better beer, joining the American Homebrewers Association. More than 37,000 members rely on the AHA for great benefits like events, web resources, Zymergy magazine, and money-saving AHA member deals. As a not-for-profit organization, the AHA relies on members to support their work to promote, protect, and grow the homebrewing hobby. Whether you're an expert homebrewer or just getting started, visit homebrewersassociation.org to join today. That's homebrewersassociation.org and join today. I'm a member. I have been for several years. I got my copy of Zymergy yesterday, I believe, and on the cover was an illustration for pumpkin beers. Very cool. It's that time of year, and we greatly appreciate the AHA's support. Now, you've seen the Basic Brewing video episode about the sour beer brewed at Fossil Cove based on my homebrew recipe. Well, I sat down with brewer Ben Mills last week for a more detailed chat, and I surprised Ben at the end of our talk with a weird homebrew that I brewed. Ben Mills, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Good to see you again, James.
We're here at Fossil Cove. I feel like I work here. I've been here so much.
You might have to give you an honorary position.
Watching brewer, because you won't let me do anything actually. But or of course I hadn't asked. young guys are climbing ladders with sacks. Of course, maybe I shouldn't say that. You're doing things very safely with heavy things.
That's exactly right.
Which is something that I probably shouldn't be doing. First of all, tell me about this beer that you gave me a little sample of.
Oh, yeah, we just released the Grapefruit Ginger Pale Ale. So it's a step up from the Randall infusion we did a month or so ago. And basically we did our Paleo Ale, which is just an American-style pale ale, with fresh-grated ginger root and grapefruit zest. Mm. And people loved it. It was actually one of the most popular, if not the most popular, Randall infusion we've done yet. So we decided to go ahead and build a new recipe and actually make a production batch of it. So we developed a new pale ale recipe based on some of the characteristics we were looking for to help accentuate the grapefruit and the pale. Or, I'm sorry, the grapefruit and the ginger. So it's kind of a, I don't know how to describe the color. It's kind of a copper, I would say.
Yeah,
pretty
that's
close
a good
to
description.
Copper. We filtered it. It's, the alcohol on it is about 5%. Mm. And we, instead of, I've kind of grown away from adding fruit additions or flavor additions to the whirlpool, just because you lose so much to fermentation. It's just a lot, you lose a lot of character to fermentation. And so we've been really leaning more heavily towards post-fermentation flavor additions. So on this one, we added the grapefruit zest and the ginger root, kind of like a dry hopping. So we, and then we also used a pound of Summits to dry hop it as well, because Summits have a pretty citrusy character, and then with the grapefruit and the ginger, and it turned out pretty well. We put it on tap last night, and if we didn't finish one keg, we got pretty close. So it was incredibly popular last night, and it, I think we'll end up making this our spring seasonal.
Yeah, it's nice. Very refreshing, and the especially the grapefruit comes through. I think the grapefruit comes through more than the ginger, but you were saying that you and Court were saying that some people were split on whether they tasted more ginger than more grapefruit.
Yeah, and we had, there's a, it was almost like battle lines were drawn last night towards the end of the evening between who thought it was the ginger coming through and who thought it was the grapefruit. So it was, if anything, it sparked some intellectual discussion last night about people's taste buds.
Well, you know, if you're going to argue about something at a bar, beer is probably the safest thing to argue about.
That's exactly right, yeah. Leave the politics and religion at home. We'll argue about the beer.
There you go. Now, how did you treat the grapefruit peel and the ginger going into the fermenter? Did you prepare it in any way?
Yeah, basically, we didn't want the... in the past, I've used... Normally, I just peel, like the oranges or a grapefruit or something. And with the oranges, it's not quite too bad because the pith isn't so thick. Mm-hmm. Grapefruits are renowned for pithiness. So, and also with, you know, the oranges, we've started doing this as well. We just basically take a potato peeler or a zester and just zest it. And that, I mean, that way we're getting just the peel that's chock full of all the essential oils that we're looking for. And so we just zested 10 grapefruits, and we ate all of the grapefruits. The grapefruits do not go to waste. Zested the grapefruits, and then just did essentially the same thing with the ginger root. We just took a potato peeler and just shaved it and shaved down about 3 roots. And all of that was probably not quite sterile or sanitary. So I just essentially had a bucket of our SantaClean sanitizer and just put everything in a bag and dipped it in there for a couple seconds. So we didn't extract, you know, we didn't lose stuff, but at the same time, let it come into contact with that for just a few seconds to kill off any bugs and let it drain real good, and then tossed it in the fermenter and transferred the beer on top of it.
Yeah, so 10 grapefruits worth of peel for how big of a batch?
4 barrels, so about 100 and a little less than 4 barrels, because it would be a transfer, so it's about 110 gallons.
So do the math yourself at home.
Yeah.
But it's a, you don't get the pith, the grapefruit pith. You do get the kind of sweet grapefruitness of it, so it turned out very well.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm super, super stoked on it. I don't know that we'll change very much. Just kind of streamline it. And yeah, well, I think scaling it up for a spring seasonal is going to be, that'll round out our list of seasonals. So
what we're tasting now, or what we're looking at now, is my homebrew. And we may want to pour the other one so we could do side by side. I brought the 48-hour sour mash beer. And then the 72-hour sour mash beer, and this is kind of what we did on the day, on the brew day, when you started the brewing process. As we sat down and we said, you know, here's 48 hours, here's 72 hours, and then, you know, let's make some decisions on what you're going to do. So first of all, I guess we should step back. And I had given you, well, there's floaty things in that one. I had given you one of the 72-hour beers just a couple of home brews for you to try, and you were kind of inspired by the whole thing.
Yeah, it's basically it was one of the first really hot days of the late spring, early summer, and I was outside planting some hops and decided to give this a try, and it was good. I was outside working, and it was good, and so I kind of decided to talk to you about scaling up a production batch of it and giving it a try. Obviously, the main reason was the issues with contamination on the brew house or the fermentation side, cellaring side, and so this was by far and away the only option we have currently for a sour beer in Arkansas or in my brewery, and would be the first sour beer in Arkansas. And so we talked about it and discussed the limitations and ramifications and everything else, and decided to go ahead and go for it and scaled it up, and we did one two-barrel batch, and tried to adhere to your protocol as closely as possible, but there were definitely some things we had to change, mid-brew.
it was interesting, the process was different from mine, just in the scale and the equipment and all. But we've got these side by side. The 48-hour one definitely has more of an aroma.
It's almost got the almost a little bit garbage pail.
Yeah, it's a little dumpstery, a little bit dumpstery on the nose.
Yep.
But it tastes good. Mm-hmm. It tastes like. It tastes a lot like apple juice.
It does. It's a little more almost grainy, too. Mm-hmm. You got a little bit of the grain coming through. But yes, very apple juicy.
Yeah, in fact, I would assume that most people, if you just sat that in front of them and asked them to taste it, they might say it's apple juice.
Yeah, it's not super tart. It's a slight tartness. It's really not much of a tartness. So yeah.
And then the 72-hour one...
much cleaner.
Mm. Oh. Now, of course, this one, your grain bill is a little bit different on this one. This one has some rye in it. Mm. But it tastes more like a beer.
Yep.
And it's tart. It's not as tart as what yours came out.
No. Yeah, that one's a hard one to explain.
Well, first of all, I mean, you did the sour mash in your mash tun, mm-hmm. which is a closed vessel, mm-hmm. And you purged the top with CO2.
Yes.
I purged mine with CO2, but mine was an enamel, kettle, and I covered it with aluminum foil. So the integrity of my CO2 purge over the course of the days was probably not the same as yours.
And we replenished ours at least two or three times, and so we just essentially just kind of left the hose in there with a fitting and just turned the CO2 on and tried to keep a blanket of CO2 so that some of the aerobic organisms wouldn't get in there and start to make some kind of the vinegary not quite what you're looking for. The Acetobacter is the main one, so tried to avoid him and focus on lacto.
Yeah, no, I guess we should go over the process again. You did a regular mash for an hour, and then since your volume was bigger than mine, you got 30 pounds of ice from the convenience store and threw it in there, and that made a dent in bringing the temperature down, but it didn't do it all the way, so you had to run some tap water in there to cool it down.
Filtered tap water.
Very important.
So we didn't buy enough ice. Next time we'll buy some more ice or have an ice machine handy. But
it worked out.
It did work out. Yeah, the ice dropped it about 15 degrees, I think, maybe 20. And we still had to drop it another 15 degrees, I think it was, 15 or 20. So we just used filtered city water, the same water we use for brewing, and cooled it down and tried to the first issue we had was how much water was going into the mash and how much we were going to be pulling out for the boil, so that our gravity was, so we hit our gravity that we were, the rough gravity we were shooting for. Because obviously the yeast or the bacteria were going to eat up some of the sugar that was set aside for the yeast. And so we were trying to factor, trying to guesstimate how much they were going to eat and what we were going to be left over with, and balance all of that with adding water to cool it down. But got it down to 120 and shut the water off, and we had about, it was pretty close to two barrels, a little over two barrels in the mash tun. So that was pretty good, and we got almost everything we needed just off of our initial runnings without sparging. Which was fine, and we sparged for, I think we just sparged for a little bit, and the grain bed was thin enough that it probably didn't do much more than pull out a little extra flavor, or sugar. So that was, that worked out okay. That's definitely one thing we had to focus on and kind of work with next time we do one of these, is the mash volume. A big question, and maybe something else to try, is whether or not to sour it in the mash tun with the grain or inoculate the wort in the kettle. And that's something Andy Sparks had mentioned from the home brewery, and I think it would be a better process as far as consistency goes, because you know your mash is always going to run off. You you don't have the guesstimation factor quite so much. And you know, you can inoculate it with just lacto, so you can boil it for 15 minutes, then cool it down and inoculate it with lacto, and hopefully that would be the only organism you're working with. Still put the blanket of CO2 on it. So it's a thought. It's something we thought about, but this was the initial experiment, and that was, I'm glad we went with it because it taught us a lot about the process.
Yeah, I think Andy's concern about this process was that for consistency, if you do what you're saying and collect your wort in the kettle, and then add a commercial sample of lactobacillus instead of inoculating with grain, unmashed grain, which is what we did in the homebrew version, and here too, you inoculated with 5 pounds of barley, two row. Having just adding the samples from White Labs or White Yeast or wherever would give you theoretically a more consistent pitch of the lactobacillus. I don't know. I can see pluses and minuses on, on both sides. We did. You did have an issue with a stuck sparge that you don't see on the video podcast, but I didn't put it in there because it was actually an issue with the with a false bottom and not the mash itself. So the mash seemed to be running just fine. You put rice hulls in it to counteract the wheat and the rye.
Yeah, it was fine. We just, there was the false bottom's two pieces, and one was slightly off, and so we got some grain. Some grain got sucked down and clogged the valve, and that was, it wasn't the mash bed was fine. It was clogging the valve was the problem. So we fixed it, and it wasn't a big deal. We didn't have any astringency in the beer or anything like that, so we were fortunate that that didn't cause any lasting impressions.
So we, the, you, on the video, you said you said this is the first intentionally soured beer in Northwest Arkansas. I know of one that was at the Hog House years ago, and I can't remember the. I think the brewer's name is Bill, and forgive me, Bill, if you're listening, but great guy and talented brewer, and he was making a wheat beer, and it just soured. Somewhere along in the process, there was something in the chiller, or the, you know, the plate chiller, or something got in there, and it turned sour. Well, he turned, so to speak, lemons into lemonade, and he added some cherry concentrate to it. Turned out to be a wonderful beer, and you know, one of my favorite beers from from that brewery. They called it a cherry saison, I think, which is not what it was. But it turned out to be a good beer. It was not intentionally soured, though. So this is the first intentionally soured beer in the area. And response has been good. I mean, it's gone.
It's gone, yeah. I think we had 4 kegs, and it was a week. Right out of a week, we went from Friday evening of 1 week to Saturday evening of the next. So 8 days was, and I would say that half of it was gone the first 2 days.
Yeah.
It was easily that Friday and Saturday, the first 2 days we had it on tap. It was, we had gone through half the batch. So.
And Andy was texting. They're loving it here. You know, Steve and I were in Salt Lake City. They're loving it here. And I was like, save some. We need to.
There was a question of whether or not it was going to last long enough. Yes.
Hold some back. I'm going to come back to town. But you were serving it with Woodruff syrup from Andy's shop and raspberry syrup.
Yep.
And you also put it through the Randall with blackberries,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. We had local blackberries from the lady that takes our spent grain. Mm. She brought us a bag of some fresh blackberries that she had picked, and it was good. The blackberries turned it pink and gave it kind of a extra tartness. We had some tartness, and then we had this, you know, this blackberry tartness. So it was good. People really liked it. And then Andy bought the traditional German syrups, mm-hmm. and which were actually written in German. So it was kind of cool. But the raspberry, which was went over super well. It added some sweetness and not very much tartness. So it really balanced the sour out a lot. And then the Woodruff, which was very good, but a very interesting addition.
We looked up, we were like, what is Woodruff? So I looked it up, and according to Wikipedia, I think it's this plant that is used in, what was it, potpourri, yep. and as a moth repellent.
Yes. Yes, so luckily I think they didn't use the actual plant to make this extraction. I'm pretty sure just by what little bit we could tell, it is a mixture of different fruit extractions that get close to what the plant use is. And so it was good. It was sweet. It was kind of waxy.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely changed the mouth feel of the beer. And then to some of us, it was a little like, it was kind of like Carmex. It wasn't off-putting by any means, but mm-hmm. it definitely reminded me of me and a few others of, you know, smelling a little tub of Carmex. So
what was the split? How many people wanted it straight? How many people wanted it with raspberry? And how many Woodruff?
I would say that it was about 50-50. A lot of people wanted to try it by itself. Mm. And so we had a lot of people get that first one. And for a lot of people, it was just too tart.
Mm.
And so one thing I'm considering is, you know, we'd just pay a lot more attention and taste it more often.
Mm.
And not worry about timing so much, you know, conveniency. But whenever it's ready to go and it reaches a certain sourness, it's time to brew it. Even if it's, you know, 11 o'clock at night, it's like, all right, let's go. Because the bacteria aren't going to quit.
Right.
And
right.
I think if we would have brewed it Sunday instead of Monday, so 48 instead of 72, I think it would have been good. But I don't know if the flavor would have been as good.
Well, you know, I don't know. Because in my experience, the aroma that I get from this 48-hour beer of mine, it smells like what the sour mash smells like, what my sour mash smelled like. Your sour mash never smelled like that.
Yeah,
it did. It never smelled like a dumpster. There was more of a tart smell to it,
yeah.
Which kind of it kind of scared me because it was different. But in the end, I think it came out better.
I agree, and I think part of that might be the CO2 blanket. Mm-hmm. I really do think that made a difference, because I can't imagine that my mash tun's any different than an enamel pot. I mean, they're
right.
essentially a big pot, and
right.
so the main thing I can think of is that a CO2 blanket is critical and is important to keep other bacteria, you know, the acetic acetobacter or acetic acid bacteria, keep some of those out and try to focus on the lacto. And that comes back to the souring in the kettle with the wort versus the mash tun and consistency. And it's a very new thing, and not new, but new to us. And it's something you aren't normally, we never discussed it in school. And I mean, it's just not a thing that, it's a traditional thing, but it's not a scientific thing. It's more of a tradition, and this is how we did it before we knew what we were doing. And so history books are more important in this one than textbooks.
You know, it's interesting because I've gotten some feedback from this with guys saying, I've tried this, it didn't work. You know, I tried it, it was nasty. I'm going to say it, Ray Daniels out there said that he had never tried a sour mash beer that didn't taste like dirty dishwater. And I replied, well, you haven't tried mine. Smiley face. And then when this came out, and this was it, that was even before we started brewing this. This is even before the brew day. We had scheduled it, but so when it came out, I tweeted a link to him to the article about how it came out and everything. I don't know if he ever read it, but anyway, so and somebody responded to him, and he retweeted, if it was a legitimate technique, then New Belgium and somebody else would be doing it. Yeah, well, there's different circumstances. I mean, it's more, you can let something sour over the weekend in your facility because you're not going to be brewing anyway. New Belgium is they're running all the time.
7 days a week.
And you're probably going to get to the point where you're going to be doing that. You're going to grow, Ben. You want to stay a small operation with one, you want to be the guy, but you're too good. You're going to be, you know, it's going to grow. But at this point, you have the luxury of having some downtime on your equipment where you can do that. Mm-hmm. So just because other people, and I asked out there on Twitter, has any other commercial brewery done sour mashing? And several people responded with breweries that are doing this. So anyway, that's just me getting defensive. But
it's a legitimate thing. For someone to say that just because two current commercial breweries aren't doing it, well, yes, they're amazing breweries and they make an awesome product, and I have the utmost respect, but they aren't the standard. And that's what's nice about craft brewing, is it's all about the craft of it. And, you know, there's an artsy side to it as well, and an innovative side and an experimental side. And honestly, I'm not doing anything that hasn't been done before. And like I said earlier, the traditional and historical, before they knew what yeast was and what was actually happening in the fermentation, a lot of beers, I mean, Berliner Weiss, Saisons, Flanders, all the sour styles that all of these American craft brewers are making now, a lot of it happened because of an inability to control what organisms got into the beer.
Yeah.
And so just because you have control over your Flanders style red now doesn't mean you're doing anything different than what they did 300 years ago. You have a microscope and
in
a lab.
I mean, if you look at the brewing now we're getting philosophical, but now, if you look at the brewing process, it is so complex, from malting through mashing through it is so complex that each one of those stages had to be discovered by accident at one point.
Yes.
It was discovered by accident and it worked and they kept it. So part of the fun of homebrewing is going back and deconstructing that and breaking the rules every now and then and saying, do we really have to do that?
Exactly.
You know, do we really have to mash out? Do we really have to, you know, like brew in a bag? Do we really have to, you know, have a mash tun? Do we have, you know, all of these rules where if you don't do them and it still works, or maybe it comes out different, you know, we're at the point in time where There are so many brewers and so many breweries. People are breaking rules all over the place, and we're just discovering new stuff. And you can't be resistant to change.
I agree totally. And so something like this is, you know, there's a lot of us can't afford to have separate hoses and separate tanks. I mean, I can't afford to put another brewery in so that we can run a sour program. We're limited, but at the same time, we love sours, and people in Fayetteville apparently do as well. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be something we play with, and we've already got some ideas about some different sours and different ways of doing things that will allow us to get close to a traditionally made sour ale, but doing it in the 21st century with what we have to do it with.
There is one question that somebody asked that when I said that we were tasting this sour wort from the sour mash, I got a response saying, don't you think you'll poison yourself? Mm-hmm. You know, is there something growing? Could there be something growing in there that's bad for you? You know, that you could kill off with a boil, but, you know, should you be tasting it from the mash tun?
That's a
legal disclaimer. We don't know.
I drank a lot of it, and I'm still alive.
This is not saying that you should drink your sour mash at home.
So I did do some research on this because it made me a little nervous as well, especially once we had that conversation, because it was some things we hadn't thought about. And obviously the number one argument in favor is that they've been doing it and have done it for hundreds of years. Mm. And so there's, you know, it was fine for hundreds of years. We're not throwing any ingredients in there that are dangerous. Really, you're just coming down to microbiology. So that was one thing that gave me some confidence in what we were doing was safe. The other thing was I did get online and read other processes for sour mashes, and a lot of it came down to the acidity of the mash prevents certain organisms from growing. And that's, I mean, that's one of the main reasons why beer is considered safer and was considered safer than water for so long, is the acidity of the product prevents certain microorganisms from growing. And then, so that's one thing, and, you know, mash is about 5.2. And as soon as that lactose started, you know, you might get a little growth, but using an anaerobic environment with the CO2 blanket and the acidity from the mash, plus the added acidity from the lactobacillus spitting out the lactic acid, you know, you're increasingly dropping your acidity. And so it should have prevented any pathogenic organisms from growing, because it's just not, they just don't, that's just not an ideal condition.
Yeah.
And then also the temperature of the mash, and we held it for so long, and it's, you know, the mash itself is almost a pasteurization process for an hour. So it's, we should be safe, and I think that's why that it has worked for so long, and that's why there was never an issue back in the day, is they were doing it without knowing it.
Yeah. You talked about pH. Someone tweeted or asked, I think it was a comment on YouTube, how did the acidity of the wort affect fermentation? Did it retard the yeast at all?
No, actually it probably could have, yes. But the yeast we're using, SAF-LO5, is a very resilient yeast, and it tends to handle higher alcohol levels pretty well, and it tends, you know, multiple generations, and we overpitched it. We definitely overpitched just because I wasn't worried about yeast profile. I just wanted beer to ferment. We were fermenting at a relatively low gravity, so I think it was like right at nine degrees Plato, and so our alcohol came out at 3.7, and you know, so yes, had it been more stressful for the yeast, and we ferment a little warmer too, it had been more stressful for the yeast, probably. Had we tried to, you know, do a low temperature fermentation, underpitched it, low oxygen, I really did try to make every other factor a yeast positive so that pH negative wasn't inhibiting. And the yeast fermented fine, and there's no there's no stressed out yeast byproducts. So I think it, no, I don't think it did. I think it was fine.
Well, I think we've covered the process. I think I'm looking forward to your playing more with sours because I'm a sour head.
Yeah.
I love sours. I have a surprise as I'm getting up, and there's the FedEx guy. Do you need to take care of the FedEx guy, or is Court going to take care of the FedEx guy?
Looks like I.
Okay. Now this, I wish I could hide the. Oh, yeah. Don't look at the lid. And it may blow. No, it didn't go. Okay. There are only three of these in existence. Don't look. Did you look?
No.
Okay. Pour the samples.
Okay.
Be interesting to see. First of all, pour carefully. There's a bunch of crud in the bottom.
This looks very thick.
It looks like it's in slow motion, doesn't it?
Look at that.
It looks like a regular beer, but the bubbles are rising.
I would say that this has got a higher gravity. It's kind of sweet smelling, but it's also kind of tart smelling too.
I wish I should have taken video of your face. Because you're going through some contortions there.
It's almost like some tart cough syrup. It doesn't taste like cough syrup, but it's got the consistency of kind of almost a cough syrupy consistency, and it's got... That is weird.
Now, spend a little time tasting it. You said tart. I don't know, your tongue may be... I'm going to shut up.
No, it's not. No, tart may be the wrong word. It tastes, is it a mead?
No.
No. It's carbonated.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear.
It's thick, it's clear.
This is, you want me to tell you?
Yes.
It's a 100% rye.
Oh,
pale
really?
Ale. Yeah.
Wow.
That is 100% malted rye that we made for the video podcast. And it was so thick. The wort was so thick. I did brew in a bag, of course.
That's pretty good.
It's now that you know what it is and not scared of it, it probably tastes pretty good. It's like a hoppy cough syrup.
It is, yeah. It's and I've always read about rye having somewhat of a phenolic character. And so it does, it's a little bit, not really off-putting, but it does have, you know, almost a Belgian-y, saison-y phenolic character. And then it is thick. I would assume that's because rye is not, it doesn't break down the way barley would. So it's probably going to have a lot of extra dextrins that you wouldn't normally see. And for it to be 100%, that's...
Yeah, you need to watch the. Maybe we can pull up the video podcast. But the wort coming off of the bag when I squeezed it, it was like snot. I mean, pardon me, but it was very viscous, and I was like, oh my god, this is horrible. And so I boiled it, and you know, it was just this rolling bucket of snot. And so when I put the yeast in, when I pitched it, it started fermenting, but it had this. Like protein break in the fermenter, and it was just kind of floating in the middle there. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. So when it came time to bottle, I said, this is nasty. This is just the nastiest stuff. So I made a 2-gallon batch, but I only bottled 3 bottles.
Oh, really?
And now I wish I'd bottled more because it's actually pretty tasty.
It's just the
mouthfeel is so weird.
It's got, it's a lot of, in rye is described as being kind of spicy. And it's...
So that's what you mean by phenolic.
Yeah, somewhat, yeah, some of the That is very interesting. It is kind of, you know, for as thick as it is, it's kind of dry. It's a little...
It's got a bunch of hops in it.
It definitely kind of coats your tongue with this thick, this syrupiness. It's kind of, that's a very interesting beer.
I don't know if there's ever been, we had to ask people if there's, if surely other homebrewers have made 100% rye beer.
I couldn't list, I'm sure a commercial brewery would step away from that just from the...
Well, you couldn't do it. You'd just have a big tub of goo in your mash tun.
That'd be rough. It smells really good, though. What hops is that?
Oh, I don't know. It's American hops. We'll have to. I didn't bring my log. I meant to bring my logbook, but I didn't bring it. But
That's a sipping beer.
It still tastes good. I made it a long time ago.
It's almost. I mean, it could be. That's good.
It's almost like a liqueur, only not nearly as much alcohol as a liqueur, but it's very cough syrupy, and a lot of liqueurs are cough syrupy, too.
Yeah, it's kind of a syrupy texture, but it's good. Very good.
Definitely, weird.
Definitely cool to see the bubbles float so slowly. Yeah. I mean, you're setting these two side by side, and you've got a very large difference in the time it takes for the bubble to reach the bottom to the top.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, there's your surprise.
Well, cool. Thank you. I appreciate that. That's good.
Well, thank you very much for the sour mash endeavor.
I appreciate your collaboration on it and helping us get it done too, because that was a great experiment and definitely something that we'll look to in the future for, you know, helping bring some cool new beers to the area.
And I have to thank Sean Coates, who was on the show originally, who walked us through the process and inspired me to do it as well. So thanks, Sean. You know, home brewing information is kind of like a ripples in a pond, you know. And so Sean has reached all the way down from, I think he's in Canada, all the way down from Canada here in Northwest Arkansas. So anyway... I look forward to more experimentation.
I do too, definitely. Let's keep it going. That's what it's all about.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, James.
Well, thanks again to Ben for taking the risk and brewing that recipe on a larger scale. It went down very well with the local customers, and I'm looking forward to more experimentation from Ben and Fossil Cove. One thing that I forgot to bring up was the vegetal flavors that Ben was getting from his sour mash. If you watched the video podcast, you saw that. Very V8 juice-like. To deal with that, Ben extended the boil to a full hour. My boil was only 15 minutes. And through that longer boil and, I guess, the yeast working on it in the fermenter, all that stuff was gone by the time it went into the glass. It was very clean, very tart. And boy, it was a tasty beer. Also, I asked for questions on Twitter, and I appreciate everybody who sent those in. But thanks to the internet service problems I was having, I didn't get to read them on the show. However, Ben took the time to answer most of those questions himself on Twitter, so it all turned out well. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are available at our shop. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beer as you take it from place to place. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. We'd like to expand our coverage to go to other places, and that sure can help. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering, and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. Our Brewer's Logbooks are on the store, too. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at BasieBrewingShop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Dynamite Dude Disco Shirt Adult Costume Standard and Sloan 3325402 G2 Urinals Optima Plus Flush Meter Retrofit Kit. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And by the way, I looked at the page for the urinal part, and it had a warning at the bottom that said, choking hazard. Choking hazard. Small parts, not for children under 3 years. So if you were looking to buy a urinal flush meter retrofit kit for your toddler, you might want to think again. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. So long.